Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Evans Mirages is a classical music consultant and producer and currently serves as the artistic director at Cincinnati Opera and the vice president for artistic planning at the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. He also runs his own firm, Evans Mirages Consulting. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thank you, Joel. It's a pleasure.
So tell us your story. How did you end up where you are today?
Well, the Reader's Digest version is that I have loved classical music since I was a kid growing up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. My dad was not a trained musician. There were two gods in our household, musical gods in our household. One was Mario Lanza, and the other was Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops. I gravitated to both of them, and I played a musical instrument starting already in elementary school. I was a clarinetist, and I played clarinet through high school. But when I was in high school, I began to get the sense that I was a good clarinetist, but I wasn't going to be a professional. But I loved getting other people excited about classical music. By that point, I had a part-time job after school in a record store in my hometown, which specialized in classical music, actually. So I began to consume, as it were, classical music by the bucketful, because of course I could buy the records at cost. I never took home a salary in all the years I worked there.
Oh, wow.
But by the time I was ready to go to university, I went to the University of Michigan. I decided that in order to be knowledgeable about classical music, besides being able to read music and perform, I needed to have an education that gave me a sense of what surrounds music. In other words, no art is created in a vacuum. So I, as a liberal arts major, actually my degree is in journalism, but as a liberal arts major, I took every music course that was available to a lit student, and I also moonlighted some of the graduate level courses at the University of Michigan School of Music through the kind intercession of one of the professors. So by the time I left the U of M in 1976, I had a well-rounded education, or at least I was exposed to the history of music, but also the history of art, political science, journalism, how to interpret the Bible in public, all sorts of those things that surround the creation and performance of music that are not music itself. And when I was done with school, I really didn't have that much of a direction, but I knew I wanted to continue doing something that promoted classical music, so I gravitated to radio. And I worked for the university's radio station in Ann Arbor from 1973, when I was in school, to 1982. And from 1982 to 1989, I lived in Chicago and worked for a powerhouse radio station called WFMT. It's still around. FMT in those days, in the early 80s, was the powerhouse syndicator of performances of orchestras and opera companies around the United States. They had contracts for the Chicago Symphony, the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Chicago Lyric Opera, the Houston Grand Opera, the San Francisco Symphony, and they created a program called Lincoln's Music in America. Not Abraham Lincoln. It was a commercial radio station. It was sponsored by Lincoln Mercury Motor Cars.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I was hired to be the producer of that program, whose premise was, if you had all the money that you wanted and all the time that you needed and you love classical music, what would you do every week? Would you go to Seattle for the Ring? Would you go to Bayreuth for the Ring? Would you go to New York for the opening of the Philharmonic season? Would you go to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania for the Bach Festival? So for 7 years, 39 weeks out of the 52, I did that. I went at the beginning of a week, recorded interviews, sometimes rehearsal material, and developed a sense of a profile of an upcoming event in classical music. I'd rush back to Chicago on Wednesday, edit the program. My boss would be the voice of the program. It would go up on the satellite in those days. No internet in those days. And we do it all over again. Wash, rinse, repeat. We do it all over again every week. So what that gave me was exposure to pretty much every important musician or composer of the 1980s, because I wasn't a journalist. I was doing an hour of free national publicity for an event. So I got to go to rehearsals. Plus, since I was a trained musician, I could ask intelligent questions. I didn't have to ask them what they ate for breakfast and why they didn't like to go on the road. We started talking about real stuff right away. So that led to the Boston Symphony, funnily enough. I'd done some programs about the Boston Symphony and eventually was asked if I wanted to try out for the job of artistic administrator. So I went from Chicago to Boston, and I was the artistic administrator for Seiji Ozawa from 1989 to 1994. And talk about exposure to all the great artists. I mean, everybody came to Boston. Yevgeny Kissin, Maurizio Pollini. We did operas and, well, we did semi-staged operas. And it was not only the winter season, but it was Tanglewood and the wonderful Tanglewood Music Center. So I had exposure to everyone. That led to the Decca Record Company. So when I was in Boston, actually it starts in Chicago, because in Chicago I did some radio programs about the recording business, and one of them was about Decca, and I met all the top brass at Decca, interviewed them. And when I was in Boston, we made a record with the Decca Record Company with Vladimir Ashkenazy. And the guy who was the head of artists and repertoire, so that's the man in a record company in the old days, or woman sometimes, thank goodness, who made all the decisions as to who would record for the company and what would they record. So the A&R director of Decca, wonderful man who has since passed away by the name of Ray Minchell, we knew each other. And when he decided he was going to retire, he gave the headhunter my name. I'd never worked for a record company before, but I sort of knew how they went. And I was a huge fan of Decca. I'd bought Decca records since I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And I was a really reluctant bridegroom, I have to say. I met with a headhunter a couple of times, and I had a great job in Boston. I was working with the Boston Symphony. But the allure of working for a record company in the mid-1990s, so the CD boom was over. The companies, all of them, the big international companies, were all going through big transition. And I thought I'd be an idiot not to try and help this particular company that I loved so much become a little bit smaller, a little more nimble, survive in the changing world of music. So my partner then, husband now, and I packed up our bags and we moved to London. And from 1994 until 2000, I was the head of the Decca Record Company's artists and repertoire. I left in 2000. The company was sold twice while I was there. I survived, I think, four presidents. But finally, the handwriting was on the wall. The record business was going to change away from the whole idea of nurturing classical music and musicians to what'll sell a few copies really quick. So that wasn't the business for me anymore. I took a golden parachute and I landed very safely into the consulting business. It was actually Tom, my husband, who said, you know, you've worked in all these different areas, radio and symphony orchestra and record companies, and you've produced operas, you've produced chamber music, choral music, contemporary music, old music. Why don't you see if there are companies out there, both in Europe and in the United States, that would like temporary help, meaning that they're in between artistic administrators, or they want to enhance their recording profile, or they want to play at the proms, or they just want to, as it were, bat above their financial weight by having an outside consultant. Mm-hmm. So I took his advice and I did it. And pretty quickly, I had a pretty impressive roster of clients, which eventually led to the Atlanta Symphony. I started working for the ASO as a consultant in 2007. Because one of my very first clients in 2000 was the Brooklyn Philharmonic, where Robert Spano was the music director.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I helped Brooklyn with their programming for 6 or 7 years. And when the ASO's artistic administrator, the beloved Frank Danz, hived off to Cleveland to work for the Cleveland Orchestra, the ASO was looking for an artistic administrator interim while they searched for someone new. So I started out on a 6-month contract for the ASO, which eventually led to a dozen years in various capacities. I was there part-time for a while, then I became full-time, then I became a VP, and I relinquished the VP role in 2018 because I'd also sort of fallen in love with another client, as it were, which is the Cincinnati Opera Company. Cincinnati Opera Company hired me on as a consultant in 2005, and the following year I became its artistic director. So for between 2006 and 2018, I had two full-time jobs.
Yeah.
Plus, I continued consulting. Eventually, I decided I needed to focus on Cincinnati Opera because the company was growing and the ASO was in great shape after many years of, as you know so well, of terrible financial problems. I thought, If I'm going to exit, it should be now when the orchestra is doing really, really well. So I relinquished my position in Atlanta full-time, went to work for Cincinnati Opera full-time, but now I'm back with the ASO once again as a consultant while you look for another artistic administrator, and I hope they'll find one soon. I love working for the orchestra, but you need boots on the ground. So here I am having this double life again and loving it because I don't have to make up my mind. I don't have to choose between do I love symphonic music or do I love opera? I love both, and for now, I get to do both.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. I think the part that I got most hung up on is, so you were producing a radio show. Is that correct?
Like
producing, was it a once-a-week radio show with a one-hour program? Okay.
It was a 54-minute program for commercial radio because you needed to leave 6 minutes an hour for commercials.
Okay. And then you went immediately from there to artistic administrator for the Boston Symphony. Is that correct?
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
That seems like a huge leap, an amazing job to move to. I guess my question about that job, though, as artistic administrator, how is that different than what you do now? Now you're vice president of artistic planning was your title for the Atlanta Symphony. But is the artistic administrator the person who helps that role?
It's different in every orchestra. It just depends on the size of the orchestra and the nomenclature they use. What I did for the Boston Symphony is exactly what I did for the ASO. And the whole title of VP of Artistic Planning is just nomenclature.
Okay.
At the Boston Symphony Orchestra, my job was to assist Seiji Ozawa in making his choices as to who would conduct in guest conducting programs, who would be the soloists, what he would conduct himself, both in the winter season in Boston and in the Tanglewood season in the summer. And funnily enough, the Boston Symphony season, the winter season in those days stretched from early September to the beginning of May. So it was about, you know, about 30 weeks, let's say, of classical programs, maybe 26, 27 sometimes. At Tanglewood, there were 24 programs in 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Because there were three programs a weekend. So the Tanglewood season was as complex as the winter season with a fraction of the rehearsal time, but of course the same great array of artists.
Right.
So yeah, I jumped in feet first. And I have to say that in all three of those moves, going from a public radio station in Ann Arbor to a powerhouse commercial station, from a powerhouse commercial station to one of the top five orchestras in the world, from one of the top five orchestras in the world to one of the top three classical record companies in the world. And I was brand new in each one of those professions when I made those moves. I think is a testament to the women and men who engaged me.
Uh-huh.
They took a leap of faith each time. Ray Nordstrand, Norm Pellegrini, and Jim Unrath at WFMT in the early 1980s, I guess, saw the energy and passion that I had for communicating classical music, and they gave me a shot. Seiji Ozawa and the late Ken Haas of the Boston Symphony saw, I guess, what had developed over the years I was working in radio, which is a great ease and familiarity with artists, and a vast knowledge of repertoire. Because if you think about it, when you work for something like the Boston Symphony, it's not just the Beethoven Fifth. It's chamber music because of the Boston Symphony chamber players. It's opera because Seiji Ozawa loved opera. It's contemporary music. They commission people like Stephen Albert and Hans Werner Henze, and you name it, every single year. So I brought to each succeeding job the accumulation of what I had learned in an ancillary profession. And so they were willing to take a risk. And all three of them took a chance because I was a first timer in all three professions.
Yeah, that's really impressive. I mean, it's definitely a testament to your attitude and the work that you're so passionate about. So tell us, what does a day of work look like? When you're sitting down with the music director planning the next season, is the music director saying to you, these are the pieces I want to play, these are the concertos that I want to play, go find me the soloists and conductors? How does that work exactly? I think everybody wants to know how the sausage is made.
Right. And it's different in every orchestra. And when you're dealing with an orchestra like the Boston Symphony, when I worked with Seiji on developing his programs, he was juggling this jigsaw puzzle of not only his commitment to the Boston Symphony, which was his primary job, but he was a much sought-after guest conductor. He was also a much sought-after recording conductor, not just with the Boston Symphony. And so putting Seiji's season together was a bit of a jigsaw puzzle as to harmoniously, as Robert Spano is fond of saying, not making him learn all of Western music every year. So He would, as a year progressed, you know, have offers to do this opera or that recording project, or be in the middle of a cycle of recordings with the Boston Symphony, of the Mahler Symphonies. And so part of working with Seiji was harmonizing the deluge that was coming towards him every year of things that he was being asked to do, as well as being the musical paterfamilias of the Boston Symphony, making certain that he cycled through some of the major repertoire that people would expect him to conduct, in addition to fitting in all the special projects. He had soloists that he loved to work with. Whenever I said vocal music, he said Marilla Franey, whether it was a Mozart Requiem or a Shostakovich song cycle. As you get to that point in your career, and Seiji was in his 50s when I started working for him, he'd been an active conductor for 35 years, and he'd developed friendships with singers, with other fellow conductors, with pianists, with violinists. And so his go-tos immediately would be the people he knew. When you get more established, it's a little more difficult to introduce new faces to you. But Seiji was different, because Seiji would be around young performers all the time in the summertime at Tanglewood, when he was there running the Tanglewood Music Center, as well as the Boston Symphony. And because he was the iconic, most famous Japanese musician alive, later on in his career, when he founded his own festival in Japan, he would also be introduced to all sorts of new generation singers, instrumentalists, pianists, and all instruments. With Robert Spano, it's a little bit different. Robert and I have known each other since Robert was an assistant conductor at the Boston Symphony. I actually sat on stage during Robert's audition, turning pages for Seiji. I sat between the violas and the cellos. In those days, violas sat on the outside of the orchestra, so I was in between with Seiji looking at a score. And Robert and I have known each other for, well, 30 years, I guess. So we now work in a shorthand. Mm-hmm. I've known Robert's repertoire well over the years, and as new pieces enter his repertoire, I've been somewhere in that orbit. So making programs with Robert is like a couple of old friends sitting on the porch telling stories to each other, because I've heard a piece that he conducted someplace else and I thought, oh, you know, I bet you'd love doing that in Atlanta. Or he'd done something at Aspen or at a guest conducting engagement of a composer he didn't know before. And he said, you know, I'd like to try that in Atlanta. And in addition to that, fairly early on in his tenure as music director of the orchestra, he developed what is now called the Atlanta School of Composers, which is this small group. It's now grown, of course, but small group of women and men whom he commissioned over and over again, on the theory that if you commissioned regularly a composer for your home orchestra, eventually your home audience will grow to expect their music and know their style. And so you build a trust with your audience, and they will come to hear a new piece by Jennifer Higdon because they like the last one. So programming with Robert is a little bit different, because we're such old friends. We know each other very, very well. We finish each other's sentences. But working with guest conductors is always a really interesting activity. Because if you look at an orchestra that does, let's say like the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, it does about 24 subscription weeks a year, 24 different programs. Robert nominally conducts 10 of them, let's say. Principal guest conductor Donald Runicles, anywhere between 4 and 6, sometimes as few as 2 or 3, but Donald does the next largest number. And then you have mostly single weeks with guest conductors. So you take a look at the repertoire first that Robert wants to do and Donald wants to do. It's sort of, you know, like the adults at the table, or, you know, they get the biggest portions of food, yeah, as it were.
Well, that's fair.
And then the kid, yeah, and the kids get the rest, right?
Yeah.
So then what you're looking for, either in your selection of guest conductors or what they will bring to the table, is to increase the variety of what the orchestra can play or will present to its public. So sometimes conductors are invited because they champion a certain repertoire. Sometimes conductors are invited because they've become friendly with the orchestra. The orchestra enjoys working with them. And quite often, and rightfully so, you take a flyer on a newcomer who you've seen elsewhere, or Robert saw conduct at Aspen, or happened to be have a free night out in Philadelphia when he was there working at Curtis and went to the Philadelphia Orchestra and saw this new conductor. So you invite newcomers. Mm-hmm. And it's like a first date.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's all there is. And sometimes it develops into long-term relationships. Like the long relationship the orchestra has had with someone like Roberto Abbado or Peter Ungen, or more recently, people like Edward Evard, and you name it. I mean, lots of wonderful conductors have come to work for the orchestra. So that planning process is a combination of continuing the mandate or the patterns that the artistic leadership has, and also increasing as much as you possibly can the variety of what the public hears from the orchestra and what the orchestra gets to engage with different styles of music making.
Who decides what the guest conductor program is?
Well, ultimately, it's Robert's decision.
Oh, it's up to Robert, not the guest conductor.
Here's what happens, generally speaking. What happens is that the artistic administrator, in this case, myself, in the years I've worked with the orchestra, with someone new, I always say to them or to their manager, what is repertoire that this conductor feels that he or she can bring to the orchestra on their first visit, which will establish a rapport with the orchestra? It may be something the orchestra knows fairly well, or it may be something the orchestra doesn't know all that well and has been hankering to play, or maybe hasn't played in a long time. So I build program ideas with the guest conductor himself or herself, and then I bring them to Robert. And then we, as it were, do a little bit of horse trading. He said, well, Shostakovich 5, I actually want to do that next year. So could you ask them to go and change that? Or he'll say, oh, Shostakovich 5, oh, I know this fellow does an incredible Shostakovich 5. I'm going to wait. I think the orchestra should have this engagement. Robert's a very generous music director in that respect. I've worked with conductors in the past who are very jealous about their repertoire and don't give anything away that is their specialty. Robert and Donald are much more generous in that way. So the programming is suggested by the guest conductors, sometimes suggested by us. Let's say we're going to be working with, let's call it Roberto Abbado. Roberto and I, in all the years we've worked together, I don't think we've spent more than 5 minutes making a program because we're on a good wavelength. And Roberto will often surprise me. He will say, you know, I've always wanted to do that wonderful suite from The Comedians by Kabalevsky. Now, Roberto Abbado, serious Northern Italian Milanese conductor, wanting to do Kavalevsky? Oh, that's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
Different, right?
Yeah.
As well as Schubert and Schumann and Beethoven and Brahms and Dvorak and all of the standard repertoire. So every once in a while, a conductor surprises you, which is lots of fun. But in general, there's something that has been unique to the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra that has changed and modified over the years a little bit and will probably change with the next music director, whoever he or she will be, which is a famous institution called War Room. This is something that was instigated at the beginning of Robert and Donald's tenure by Alison Vulgamore, who was the chief executive when they were both engaged to be the artistic leadership of the orchestra. Alison felt that the more people you have involved in the decision-making process, the more buy-in you have across the institution. And so these meetings were instigated where not only Robert and Donald were present, and Alison and the artistic administrator, but the marketing director, the librarian, the personnel manager, the education and community engagement director, the artist assistant, the director of choruses, Norman McKenzie. Because no programming decision is made in isolation. And many programming decisions have financial consequences, either in terms of their expense or the need to raise extra money for a commission, or it's a fancy project like the Verdi Requiem, which requires four powerhouse soloists, or it's a work that is not in the public domain, therefore the library incurs a cost in renting it and paying the royalty for its performance. So what developed at Atlanta uniquely at first, there are other orchestras that were trying this or a variant of this now, is a collaborative process of making programming, but the buck ultimately stops at Robert's desk. Contractually, most American orchestras, the music director, they have the last word as to what goes in the brochure. And so the process in Atlanta has been amazingly egalitarian with Robert at the head. Robert's the captain of the ship, as it were, artistically. But he listens to good advice. And one of the most amazing things about War Room that I loved all the years that we had it regularly was that good ideas came from everywhere. And sometimes from the most unexpected corner, a great programming idea would emerge and Robert would say, that's brilliant. Why didn't I think of that first? Well, by the time it's in the brochure, I will have.
The last piece of that I have a question about is when it comes to hiring guest artists and soloists, because they fit into this too. Is a concerto decided upon and then you go out and try and find that soloist? Or do you decide what soloist you're interested in first and then work the process from there like a guest conductor?
It's the latter. You would never want to fit a square peg in a round hole. You would never ask someone whose specialty is Mozart to play Brahms.
Right.
Oh, they could, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, there are lots of pianists who can play just about anything. Also, soloists have the same sort of challenge, particularly active and busy ones, that conductors do. And so let's say it's the 2015-16 season, and we wish to engage Joshua Bell to be on a subscription concert with Robert. One of the first things I ask Joshua Bell's manager is, what are the concertos that Joshua is presenting in that season? Because there are some performers who play everything all the time. But there are others, because they are busy and because they also, like conductors, want to harmonize their repertoire, they will say, well, in this particular season, Joshua will play the Shostakovich First Concerto, will play the Brahms Concerto, will play the Tchaikovsky Concerto, probably not the Mozart Concertos. There's a certain limit to what any soloist will take on during the course of a season.
Okay, that makes sense. And so then when it comes to that, are you the point person who contacts every manager for every soloist because you have the relationships with them now? Or how does that work?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. It's the artistic administrator's job to make all of the connections, whether that's with soloists or conductors or composers. With composers, it's a little bit different because usually, at least in Atlanta, a composer will come with a new piece. Let's say it is Jonathan Leshnov, who comes to the orchestra to have his flute concerto premiered by the orchestra. Actually, not world premiere, but played by the orchestra. Everybody goes crazy over it, and Robert says, okay, what do you want to write next? That's how a commission is born quite often.
That makes sense. Let's shift topics here a little bit. Given what we've been through in this past year, how do you see the profession changing as a result of COVID, for example?
Digital is here to stay. I think one of the salutary things has been we can reach, as institutions, people who may no longer want to come to concerts because they are older, don't want to drive at night, live far away, have obligations that keep them from dedicating 20 Saturday nights to coming to a symphony orchestra. And so I think one of the things that we have learned is that having a digital presence, a genuine digital presence, meaning full performances, is a valuable addition to the arsenal that makes us continue to be valuable to the public that we serve. It can spread the word of the quality of what happens in Atlanta much farther than a regional tour can. I'm not saying that we should not go to Carnegie Hall or travel to Europe or do all the things that orchestras have done historically, but the digital platform, particularly with the sophistication of the technology and post-COVID, the lack of a necessity of having only 35 players on stage and, you know, having the whole orchestra on stage, I think is a tremendous boon to the orchestra. And I'm not talking about just digital, meaning the transmission of performances that we create for our paying public in the theater as well, but also the other things that have grown out of this pandemic. I'll give you a wonderful example that is in process right now. The Atlanta Symphony Orchestra had been given a substantial grant by what is called in Atlanta the Hala Foundation in Atlanta. This is a family foundation that is dedicated to promoting German culture. They are German-American immigrants historically, and so they gave the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra a grant to produce the then sadly canceled production of Tristan und Isolde, Wagner's great tragedy. So the development team of the Atlanta Symphony went to the Hala Foundation after the cancellation and said, could we think of some other way to retain this grant? And the Hala Foundation said, well, make a suggestion. So I sat down with Robert and I said, Robert, you know, what people don't really know in Atlanta is how much you know and love the music of Bach. Yes, you've done the John Passion, the Matthew Passion, and the B minor Mass. But when people think of Bach in Atlanta, they think of Robert Shaw, of course, because he was such a towering titan. But what they don't think of is that Robert, who went to Oberlin University and who's such a Baroque music geek, but happens to be a modern symphonic conductor, knows a boatload about Bach. He's also a pretty good pianist and can play a lot of the keyboard music. I said, Robert, why don't we figure out a way to do a festival of the music of Bach? Not very traditional for a modern symphony orchestra. And then our television producer, Helan Warshaw, who's done all of the digital concerts for the ASO this last year, is basically, his main occupation is as a documentarian. He does concerts because he's really good at it, but he likes making music documentaries. So we brought Helan in, and he said, wait a minute. Why don't we do sort of 24 ways of looking at Bach? Let's not make them hour-long programs. Let's make them 10-minute programs. Let's do that like the 24 films about Glenn Gould. Let's do short programs, each one of them focusing on an aspect of Bach. We can play orchestral music. We can play chamber music. We can play vocal music. Robert can play. Members of the orchestra can have solos. So that creativity has created what's in process now, which is this series of 24 programs based on the 24 preludes and fugues from the Well-Tempered Clavier, 24 programs about Bach, where Robert is host. And these will be on GPB. They'll be on our YouTube channel. This is what I'm talking about, the creativity that is born out of this terrible time, is that you take the resource of this great group of performers that is not only a great orchestra, but they're great individuals. There's chamber music that goes on inside the orchestra. We have the greatest amateur symphonic chorus in the nation, if not the world.
That's true.
We are a hotbed of great singers who live in Atlanta. So this In the Key of Bach, as the program will be called, is another example of the future for our institution to say, let's look at the institution as a hotbed of creativity in education, in community engagement, in the symphonic programs we do, in the chamber music that we play, in the soloists who reside within our orchestra, and the world-class talent that lives in our city. Let's harness all of it. Let's be that engine for musical culture, not only for the city of Atlanta, but outside of the city of Atlanta, that the digital platform has allowed us to do.
Yeah, I think that really is the silver lining. We've talked a lot about this on our podcast and how now teaching a virtual lesson is acceptable. And there's other things that we can do that a year ago, people wouldn't have been willing to do. And I think there was also probably a lot of resistance in the orchestra community about putting everything that we're doing out there virtually, because we might be eating into our own audience and have them not come to the hall. So this, I think, is a pretty positive change.
Well, and I think that fear is a fallacy, in part because I know that, for example, when the Glimmerglass Opera Festival put on sale a limited number of tickets at a relatively high price because of the way they had to do their programs for this summer, they sold out their entire season in 24 hours. People are so hungry for live music. I'm not saying that digital music will replace live music. James C. Petrillo, one of the early leaders of the American Federation of Musicians, said it best. There's nothing so good as live union music. And I don't think we're going to lose the joy of the communal experience of being in the same room where the music is being made. Nothing substitutes for that. Nothing will ever substitute for the electricity you feel in a theater when an operatic performance is catching fire, or when an orchestra is playing at a blazing white heat. But it does allow us, these new platforms, to reach more people and to entice people to come into our theater, to come into the house and experience it the way that only live music can be experienced.
It's also really nice because friends and family that live farther away have been able to watch our concerts this year, which is a new thing.
Exactly.
It's been a challenge because it's very hard to play a concert. It's also not the same as having an audience in the hall when you play a concert. There's an energy that comes. So I know exactly what you're talking about, but reaching more people, I think, is the goal here. But given the other side of what's been going on in this past year, I think we're really in a time of purposeful and meaningful change with regards to diversity, equity, and inclusion. So how do you see your role in these efforts in the symphonic world?
It's one of the things that has energized this phase of my career, no question about it. I have an unfair advantage in the world of diversity, equity, and inclusion because I run an opera company. And the diversity of singing artists has long been greater than instrumental artists or composers or conductors. And so I've, for the last 20 years plus, even before working for the Cincinnati Opera, had the privilege and the joy of working with an incredibly diverse group of artists, whether they were from the world of Korea and China and Japan, where so many young opera singers have come from in this last generation, or the incredible array of African-American talent that has exploded in the last 25 years. And they're all on the Cincinnati Opera stage because they're the best. I mean, higher quality. And it just happens to be that some of the greatest singers working today in our country are diverse. It's harder in the world of instrumental music because of conservatory training. If you talk to most African American singers, they will say, where did you get your start? I got my start in church. Mm-hmm. And so there was a, as it were, a farm team to the conservatories of this country from church musicians whose beautiful voices were discovered in their churches. With instrumentalists, with conductors, with composers, it's been harder and it's taken longer and it will take some time still. But what I'm happy about is that now there is energy behind that across the nation. When the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra's 21-22 season brochure comes off the press, you will see a sea change in the programming of the orchestra. It's been a mandate that comes right from the board and Jennifer Barlamin and Robert Spano to say, we simply must seek out, promote, and commission new music from African American and Asian and women composers to really, as it were, look at the BIPOC world as the next area of explosion of creativity. That doesn't mean that there's not something to be learned new about the Schubert Unfinished Symphony. But the Schubert Unfinished Symphony is safe.
Yeah.
It's going to be there for the eons. If we are to say that we have contributed any value to the culture of our country going forward, we must do this. And I'm really happy to see that Atlanta has embraced this. It had a long time ago. One of the things also that I think is important to remember is that the first composer that Robert Shaw reached out to when he became music director of the Atlanta Symphony was T.J. Anderson. Mm-hmm. T.J. Anderson was then a very young composer living in Atlanta, and he and Mr. Shaw together reconstructed Scott Joplin's only opera, Treemonisha, and gave the modern premiere of the opera in its orchestrated version. Shaw went on to encourage the work of Alvin Singleton, who is now, of course, a great granddad of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra's commissions.
Yeah.
So it started with Mr. Shaw, and it accelerated with Robert, and it is now at warp speed as we enter this next phase of the orchestra. But the ASO has had a good tradition of diversity. It now is getting better at it, and I'm really proud of it because we're also capitalizing, as it were, on the incredible talent in the Atlanta area. You will see at least three composers on Atlanta's 21-22 season who have Atlanta roots. They don't live in Atlanta anymore. They've gone on to other things, but they got started in Atlanta. And I think that's something also to be very proud of.
That's great. Yeah. So you've had a real dream of a career. I can't imagine if you had charted a path for yourself that it could be any better. It seems like you did exactly what you wanted to do and the doors opened for you and you've had tremendous opportunity. But if you could go back and do it all over again, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Get a business degree. I think the most important thing that I had to learn on the job and caused me the most struggle early on was not having had a master's in business. I learned it on the job, and I could read a balance sheet with the best of them nowadays. Mm-hmm. And because I worked in the for-profit sector, I can also read a P&L, which is different than most artistic administrators. Get a business degree. Be as rounded as you can. Know as much, because nothing happens without money in this profession. And nothing happens without the good management of money in this profession. And we do not live in the la-la land of state-supported music where 80% or 70% of your budget comes from the government. We earn nearly every penny that we have to spend, whether it is through contributed income or earned revenue from ticket sales, which is still only a fraction of what we need to be a solvent organization. So to anyone out there who wishes to pursue this life of helping organize music and creating the atmosphere where performers can do the best, know your numbers. It will be your best help when you are in a very important meeting trying to decide what to keep and what to jettison, because that will always be the case. You will always never have enough money to do every single one of your dreams. But if you're smart about it, you can realize them at least closer to your dream.
Yeah. So do you have any other advice that we haven't covered for our listeners seeking to make a career in music, since you've seen so many different sides of this career?
Be an omnivore. There are only two kinds of music, good music and bad music. You should know as much about hip hop and rap and jazz and throat singing and ancient polyphony and who is the hottest kid composing in the local conservatory. There is no end to the amount of music you must absorb as a thinking planner. Because as I said to you at the beginning of our conversation, music is not created in a vacuum. Music is created as part of the fabric of our society. And our society has so many levels and so many areas and so many corners and so many backgrounds. For example, if you look at the music of George Gershwin, to go back several generations, George Gershwin, when he came to write classical music, had had a 15-year career as a writer of Tin Pan Alley songs and musicals. The American musical vernacular was in his genes. Yet when he writes the concerto in F, the slow movement of the concerto in F sounds like Rachmaninoff. He had absorbed the music around him to create the music that was uniquely his. And I offer to anyone who wants to do this kind of work the advice of there is no music that does not need your attention. Because in some way, somehow, at some time, you will need to be fluent enough in that genre to make a respectful decision about either a commission or listening to a performer that you may think, wow, that's something I have never heard before, but it's good. Mm-hmm. Quality is going to be the one thing that you will need to keep as your byword, but quality happens in every area of music.
Yeah, that I think that's great advice. I mean, I always have tried to listen to any different type of music I can get my hands on. And when I was raising my kids, I would listen to what they listened to in the car rather than make them listen to what I do for a living, because I felt like it's their expression and I want them to be exposed to as much different music as possible. What music would people find you listening to that's not classical, given your last answer?
Greek dance music.
Really?
I'm a Greek American kid and I love Greek dance music. And I listen to it all the time. It's my best cleaning the house music. And I wait till Tom has to go out on an errand and I play it really loud.
That's great. So where can people find you on social media?
I have taken a vacation from Facebook, so you won't find me on Facebook. I do have a post from time to time on the Cincinnati Opera website. I'll write the occasional piece for the company. I've thought long and hard about social media. And for someone who does what I do, I don't have a lot to say. What I have to say comes out in the work that I do. And so consequently, my expressions on social media are mostly in the end product of what I've helped plan.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thank you so much, Joel. It's a pleasure. And you know, talk about hidden talents. All those years that I have watched you play so beautifully in the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, who knew you were such a great radio host?
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Christina Smith, principal flute of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like us to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us, @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Be sure and subscribe to the Cello Sherpa podcast so you'll be notified when our next episode posts. Today's episode was produced, recorded, and edited by me, Joel Dallow.